Rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first case, 2022-0515, in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Justin Tanchek, on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Bremke, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the court, Giovanna Bremke on behalf of Mr. Justin Tanchek. We've all been in a social setting, maybe a pretrial room, and the topic of prison comes up. And someone says, oh, I could make it 6 months, I could make it a year, a couple years. One of my favorite bailiffs indicates that she could make it a little bit longer because she used to cut hair and it would make herself a little more comfortable in prison. And while that may be a fun topic of discussion, those are the real conversations that criminal defendants in Ohio are having with themselves and their families when they enter a plea. Will I survive this sentence? Will my mom survive this sentence? How old will my children be when I get out? And will I get my cancer treatments while I'm in prison? Those are all real discussions. And they are all considerations when entering a plea. For this reason, Criminal Rule 11 has recognize the magnitude of entering a plea and accepting responsibility absent a trial. My colleague from the OACDL in his brief had mentioned that only 2.3% of cases go to trial in Ohio. Chief Justice Kennedy, you have mentioned in the Lafler v. Cooper case that we are really not a system of trials anymore, we are a system of pleas. For this reason, it has been held that Criminal Rule 11 should be substantially complied with. And the Court of Appeals in this case has already determined that the trial court violated Mr. Tanchek's constitutional rights and Criminal Rule 11 when he failed to inform Tanchek of the mandatory consecutive nature of his failure to comply count. He pled to an indictment of 8 counts. One of them contained a mandatory consecutive.
But do we know that's right? I mean,
do we know what's right?
That there's a duty to inform about the mandatory consecutive nature of counts. We've never held that, right?
Well, the state conceded it.
The state can concede it, but that's still an open issue, though. We can't concede it.
Sure. Well, this again.
We're going to have to decide one way or another, aren't we, to decide this case?
I believe there has been, although I agree with you, there hasn't been, and that's the trouble with this case and perhaps why you accepted it, there isn't a lot of cases on point here.
Should we even decide this case if we have that issue lurking in the background?
I don't think that should prohibit you from deciding the case. Not only has the state conceded it, but it's been decided by the Court of Appeals and the state hasn't raised that issue here.
Ms. Bremke,
yes.
If I'm looking at Criminal Rule 11 and specifically when I get to C2, one of the requirements is that the court inform the defendant of and determine that the defendant understands the effect of the guilty plea or no contest. When I read the effect of the plea of guilty, is that a basis upon which your argument is made and the Court of Appeals decision was made regarding that issue?
Yes, I think that understanding all of the consequences, the effect of the plea and what, again, the magnitude of accepting responsibility and what that's going to look like for this defendant in the future and knowing all of those possible consequences.
I'd like to ask counsel about the remedy that was ordered in this particular case. Both sides conceded error and the court ruled that there was error and ordered it back, quote, for further proceedings. What does that mean, for further proceedings? Can they go to trial on that one count?
I'm glad you asked that, because I believe there's two possibilities here. My client can go back to the trial court and, number one, plea, but where does that put him? It puts him in the same position as if the judge didn't tell him of the mandatory consecutive nature of the plea. So
why would that be?
Well, he could plea again.
Because one, he clearly knows about it now, but it is still the trial court's responsibility to tell him.
Well, there's no discretion there. So it's not like and again, when criminal defendants view this, they view it as, you know, this is going to be my sentence. He didn't know, and it's not going to alleviate that by going back and pleading. The judge has no discretion but to impose the mandatory consecutive.
Well, but if he goes back, he can plead not guilty.
Right. So that's the second option. The second option would be to go to trial. And what I would submit to you is he can't receive a fair trial upon remand because in this case, Mr. Tanchik was on a motorcycle and his passenger was flown from the motorcycle. She passed away because of that. And there's no way to have a trial, fair trial, in which all of that wouldn't come in. So he's...
Why not? I mean, it would have come in the first trial.
It would have, but again, that's something that he wouldn't have considered when he entered the plea to the other counts. He didn't consider that, he didn't make the decision to bifurcate this one count. He, you know, when he entered that plea, he was accepting responsibility as a whole, not knowing the considerations that he was getting into. So, again, I don't believe that he can receive a fair trial just on the one failure to comply count.
Well, you're saying failure to comply is separate and apart from all of those other charges.
Right, but...
The state still has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right, but inevitably, the facts of those other, it's ag vehicular homicide, the fact that his girlfriend at the time passed away, that they were on a motorcycle.
But what does that all have, as Justice Fisher said, that would come in anyway, but still the elements of failure to comply haven't been met with all of those things you just said.
Yes, but again, that's not what he considered when he entered the plea. So
what did he consider?
Well, and I think that the Court of Appeals makes a point about saying there was no sentencing agreements, and therefore there's this contractual situation. They rely on Maggard and some other cases talking about...
Because nobody said we think you can get out with 7 or 8 years.
Correct. But I think there's a distinction there, that while there was no sentencing agreement, this isn't a sentencing issue. This takes my client back to time of the plea. It vacates the entire plea. So
how can it not be a sentencing issue when it would seem like you're saying your client entered the plea not intelligently and not knowingly because the failure to comply sentence is required to be served consecutively? That's a sentencing thing. That it gives him more time than maybe he thought he would get.
I agree with you, but I want to contrast that to Saxon, yeah, which this court is familiar with, where they were simply, first of all, they were only appealing one individual count in that case. But also, in Saxon, they were saying that sentence was erroneous. In this case, we're backing it up a little bit even further. We're backing it up to the plea and saying the entire plea should be vacated. And that goes back to Justice Donnelly's question, where does that leave my client after the Court of Appeals ruling? And that leaves him with no conviction on the failure to comply, as opposed to cases like Saxon and some of the other cases that were cited, where it was what I deem as simply a sentencing issue, because only the sentence is going to be vacated, but the conviction stands.
Doesn't our case law say when both parties concede error, you go back to where the error occurred? For instance, if a trial court fails to merge two counts, we don't say go back and just deal with those counts. We send it back for a new sentencing hearing. Is that correct?
Yes, and the error here occurred when he was failed to, there was two distinct hearings, the plea hearing and the sentencing hearing, and he was failed to inform at the time of his plea of the mandatory consecutive nature.
Ms. Bremke,
yes.
I'm going back to Criminal Rule 11C2, and I read you parts of B, and now I'm looking at A, And it's in the rule that he has to be informed of the maximum penalty involved. So if the maximum penalty includes a stacking of two of the charges to which he pleads, he needs to know at least that those two are going to stack. And I mean run consecutively. And because I'm concerned about the Court of Appeals opinion referring to the sentencing package doctrine being dead, and I don't think this even involves the sentencing package doctrine, because what is here is statutory.
I agree with you, and I think that there is some confusion in this case law, because there's nothing directly on point, some confusion in this case law of just mandatory time, when it's mandatory time, or when there's consecutive nature. But this is mandatory and consecutive, and the reason that matters is because what a sentence on one count when it's mandatory consecutive is automatically going to extend that time. So he received the 7 years plus the 2 years. That's automatic. It relies on the other counts.
Shouldn't we have some evaluation of what he expected his time in prison to be? You started off very eloquently in your argument with what defendants consider when they're being sentenced, and it's the amount of time they're going to spend in prison.
Sure.
So what was his... One, did he have an expectation? Two, what was it? Three, is that something that should factor in our analysis? What if he got less time overall than he thought he would get?
Well, and I think Justice Donnelly does a really great job in his law review article, The Sentencing by Ambush. And while that's not all applicable here, because I'm saying this is a plea by ambush, this is even further than the sentencing by ambush. But in his law review article, he talks about that and how, you know, what do defendants expect to get? And part of that consideration is what they were advised by their attorneys. And we can't know what people were advised of their attorneys. And I included in my brief in this court conducted judicial notice, Mr. Tantric's attorney has advanced dementia and is now suspended from the practice of law.
Well, and the prosecutor didn't say, Your Honor, it's consecutive time, when the judge was giving what a sentence could be. And if I recall correctly, the judge did say they could be served consecutively, his sentences. I know that this charge is a mandatory consecutive nature.
It is.
But if I recall, the judge did say that you could give consecutive time. If the mandatory nature was not said by the trial court during the sentencing, not only was it defense counsel's obligation, but it was the state's too, to say, Your Honor, the conviction on the failure to comply would be a mandatory consec.
Correct. And I think that when somebody is entering a plea, it's a contract, and everybody's getting, giving and getting something.
Second.
Yes.
It's not a contract when you enter a plea. It's a contract when you enter a plea deal. There's no plea deal here.
I think that everybody's giving something. The state is getting a benefit of a conviction without a trial. The judge is getting an efficient docket. And Mr. Tantric should know of everything. When you enter into a contract, you should know of all the possible consequences. And he is getting...
What's the quid pro quo with the state? The fact that they don't have to...
The fact that they don't have to go to trial. The fact with Mr. Tantric that he should get consideration for that. Our sentencing factors allow for accepting responsibility.
And is it clear that he did not get consideration for that in his sentence?
I would submit to you he
didn't get maxed out on everything.
Right. No, but I think we wouldn't be here if he got what he wanted, what he expected, or less than he expected.
But what did he expect?
He was, and
is that in the record?
It's not in the record, no. So, but I can submit that he did obviously expect substantially less, or we wouldn't be here. But I would like to reserve the rest.
So I looked at the sentencing entry in this case, and it doesn't even correctly reflect that failure to comply is a mandatory consecutive sentence. It has language as if the judge considered it in a discretionary fashion and says that this sentence is necessary to protect the public.
Sure. I would agree with you, and I think that that's another consideration, is that in our society, in our legal system, we assume that everything is going to be run concurrent, and that's why you have to have that language, not in this case because it's mandatory consecutive, but that makes it even more suspect in this case to scrutiny, because our legal system builds in that you should have concurrent time. If not, then the judge needs to inform you. So I will reserve the remaining of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Ms. Paprocki.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, Lindsay Paprocki for the state, dividing time with the AG's office. Because Justin Tanchik's plea to failure to comply has already been vacated, the state submits that the remainder of Justin Tanchik's pleas must remain undisturbed and that the Ninth District's decision on the remedy question be affirmed.
So how does that work? So it goes back with the charge for failure to comply, then what?
He is at the stage of his plea.
So he can plead guilty or not guilty or no contest?
Correct.
And if he pleads not guilty, what happens?
It goes to trial.
And if he's convicted of that, he gets the same amount of time he's got now? Because could he get, I guess not necessarily, the judge could give, the sentence is not mandatory, just the consecutive nature, is that correct?
Well, he'll be before the court on one count.
Right, but is the sentence mandatory on that count if he's convicted? Or just the consecutive nature of the sentence?
Well, I would submit that the sentence is not consecutive to any, he would be before the court on one count. So there's no.
But he's serving time on the other counts.
Correct.
So if he's convicted, what would be the options of the trial court?
To run the sentence consecutive to any other prison time imposed.
But the judge wouldn't have to sentence him to prison.
Correct. And the state asked this court to conclude that to the extent of failure to advise on one count of a plea occurs, it does not require this court or that pleas entered on other counts to where there were proper advisements made where proper advisements that were made requires the court to vacate all of those other counts.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Hypothetically, taking back to the beginning of this case, if the defense were to motion the court to sever the failure to comply from the more serious count, the vehicular homicide, I assume the state would object to that because it's inextricably related to each other in the facts. I mean, there'd be no reason to sever that, right? If you were at the beginning of the case and the defense said, we want to try the failure to comply separately from the vehicular homicide in this case.
There would likely be no reason to sever it.
Right. Isn't it problematic that the Court of Appeals
But the plea here was made to all counts of the indictment, all eight counts of the indictment, and he entered into that plea with being advised of the maximum penalties on each count. And Justin Tanchik, he argued his assignments of error separately in the Ninth District, and he essentially argued that his pleas could be divided when he did that. He argued failure to comply could be vacated in one assignment of error, and he argued that his entire plea should be vacated under principles of contract law. He argued that his plea was part of a larger plea agreement. And inherently doing that, he argued that failure to comply could be separated out.
Well, but just because he argues that, what if this court were to decide based on the appellate court's, based on the concession and the understanding that the trial court erred in not telling the mandatory nature of the consecutive service, could this court say it's all got to go back and start over? Would there be legal basis for that?
That it's all got to go back? That right. The entire plea has to go back?
Because Ms. Bremke stated, if it's all one big decision of all the counts to plead guilty, with the sense of how long am I going to be in prison. This error, alleged error, affects the whole time of service in prison. And so if there's not a clear understanding of the big picture, should the big picture go back and start over?
We would submit that the big picture should not go back and start over, and that's based on language in Crim Rule 11, that you have to be advised of the maximum penalty on each count, and the language in this court's holding in Johnson.
Well, wasn't he advised of the maximum penalty on the failure to comply?
Yes, he was. He was advised as to the maximum penalty as to the failure to comply.
So what's the error?
We would submit under Johnson that there is no responsibility to advise as to consecutive sentences.
But doesn't that relate to consecutive sentences that are discretionary? I mean, this count is it's one of a handful of crimes at the legislature. There's not a lot of crimes like failure to comply that if the judge decides to impose prison and there are other counts, the judge has no discretion but to sentence that consecutively. It's different from whether the judge decides later at sentencing when they have discretion to run things consecutive.
Correct, if the judge imposes prison time on that count. And it is, and there are courts that have deviated from the rule of Johnson, as the Ninth District has and as the Eighth District has, but Johnson has never been overruled and it remains good law. This court has never said that Johnson applies in that way.
And we wouldn't have to overrule it. We could just say it applies in this particular case because you're dealing with these counts that have mandatory. I mean, that's the crux of the error that both sides conceded, that the defendant wasn't informed about the nature of this crime, that the judge has no discretion. If he imposes prison, he's got to serve every single day on that count before he begins day one on the more serious count.
And I think, again, that goes to my argument about the first assignment of error, which the state has conceded. And we're here on Mr. Tianchik's proposition of law that goes to the Ninth District's remedy question.
So if you can't sever them for trial, it's really not appropriate to sever those two for trial. Why are you arguing otherwise now?
You can sever them for trial.
But you said advisably not.
A defendant can make the motion for severance.
And you said it would be unlikely that that would happen.
I don't want to tie myself to that, obviously. But I'm saying that cases do proceed in the justice system on a count by count.
If it's like a weapon under disability, that means the person has a felony before, and you don't want to tell the jury that, so that's usually tried separately to the judge. But this one was really sort of endemic to what happened in the whole situation for the 8-count plea, right? Or 9 counts, however many it was.
8 counts, eight correct. Counts. I would agree, but I would also argue that the error occurred as to one count, and that is what the Ninth District determined, and there was no overall effect as to the entire plea necessary for it to be vacated. And Tianchik has offered no prejudice as to the entire plea. And if I could, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for the AG's office.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Kearney.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court.
Mr. Kearney.
Yes.
Couldn't wait to ask you this question.
Can't wait to answer it.
As Justice DeWine brought up earlier, the fact that the state conceded, well, first of all, do you agree with the concession that the trial court erred in not telling Mr. Tianchik the mandatory consecutive nature of the sentence?
In part. We agree that Mr. Tianchik personally gets the benefit of that as a matter of judgment here because that is a concession below. However, We believe the court should avoid any holding as a matter of law for future defendants that there's any remedy here to be had at all, because a trial court taking a plea simply has no duty to address consecutive sentences, regardless of whether they're mandatory.
What's your authority for that?
Johnson and the text of Rule 11 and the entire system, which is all about maximum sentences or the worst case scenario. And here's the way it works. The whole idea here is that all of the ideas of minimum sentence or your mid-range or your likelihood or what's an allied offense, that's between you and your counsel. What we tell a court to do at the bare minimum is warn this guy of the worst case scenario. So if you just take three simple counts instead of the eight here and say, you might get up to eight and three and three, and you just stop there and don't explain anything else about allied offenses or consecutive. We say in Johnson, this court says in Johnson, you assume the worst case scenario is 8 plus 3, that's 11, plus another 3, that's 14. So you assume max and stack. Then anything that comes down from there, that's bonus, whether you get a benefit or not. And the fact that one of those happens to be asterisked as, that one you have to do, that does change your expected range, but it doesn't change your maximum. It doesn't drive up your maximum. And indeed, each of the courts that has found this error has just said, well, that's mandatory, not consecutive. Mandatory, not discretionary as to consecutive. And the problem with that reasoning is, yes, that does superficially seem like a difference, and it is for expectation, but it's not a difference for maximum. It doesn't increase your maximum. It just means it can't come down as much as you'd hope.
So you say there's full compliance with Criminal Rule 11.
Exactly, because literally it says maximum, and he was told 8 and 3 plus a gaggle of other things.
But Mr. That's Carney,
If that's the case, should we dismiss this case as improvidently accepted or decide the issue of whether indeed it was error for the Court of Appeals to reverse because the mandatory consecutive nature wasn't explained?
Well, as appellee side, we never mind a improv because we think this is a bad vehicle to answer a remedy question when there's no violation. But if the court does reach it, we think you can, because you always define a remedy scope relative to what is the nature of the violation. Is it count-wide or is it case-wide? And if it's not a violation at all, then you can't classify it as count versus case when it's just a big zero. And here I want to keep in mind—
But Mr. Carney,
yes.
I need my question answered.
Sure, certainly.
And we've got a section of the criminal code that says it's presumed that sentences are concurrent unless otherwise stated. So you stood here and you said that if you get the maximum for every count that you plead to, that you should just assume it could be as bad, they could all be stacked. When the statute says otherwise, I mean, can you really do that?
Sure. The presumption doesn't change anything and actually supports us for two important reasons. The first is that the presumption is just that. It's a presumption, but it can be overcome in the rare case, and you might still face that stacking. And so you don't want to give them the false hope, particularly on the front end, and Johnson talks about this. On the front end, when you're just accepting a plea, you haven't heard all the trial evidence, you haven't had a pre-sentence report, you can't promise the guy, I said 8 and 3 and 3, but it'll probably just be 8. If anything, that's giving someone false hope and not warning them of the full worst case scenario.
And
he actually might have been a candidate for C4 because, as I understand it, he committed a crime, another OVI, while he was on bond, which is one of the triggers in C4 for having another crime committed.
But when you go to prison, when someone goes to prison, there's an entry from the trial court that has a sentence. And the sentence isn't 8 sentences. It's one sentence showing here's what your term is on all these. I'm having problems following your logic.
It's not, Your Honor, because actually when you get your sheet, it does have everything listed. And in fact, that matters because if one of those gets thrown out on review, whether state review or federal habeas, that only pops out that one. If you have something that has nothing to do with Rule 11, where there's a sufficiency problem on the rape but not the kidnapping or the ag homicide but not the OVI, then yes, you are going to get that sentence popped out. You're not going to get a whole do-over. Everything is count-based. I also want to mention that the other problem with the presumption, aside from that it can be overcome, is that we don't presume that a defendant sort of has this half knowledge or this just right Goldilocks knowledge of, well, I expect this presumption, but I don't expect stacking. If you presume he's a blank slate and he knows only what the court tells him, then he has no reason when he hears 8 and 3 and 3 to do anything but assume the worst of 14. Anything that comes down to 9 or whatever other number is bonus because you expect the worst, and we warn him about the worst. I see that my time is almost up, so I want to briefly mention that Rule 11 is, keep in mind here, this isn't a constitutional requirement. This court said in Vini that the maximum sentence bar is part of what is rule imposed above and beyond your constitutional right to jury trial, et cetera. And this court is the lawmaker for the rules. If this court thinks there's a policy reason to change the rules to talk about expectation, this court could put on its other hat and change that rule, but it hasn't done so. Johnson says we don't do this, and so this court should not do otherwise. And so we ask the court to, yes, let him be the last through the gate or simply improv the case, because there's no reason to warn anyone of anything beyond the worst case scenario, and he was. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Brimke, you have a minute, 15 seconds.
Thank you, Justices. I did want to address Justice Stewart's question about what's your authority here. And I think that the Attorney General's response was, well, the system and Johnson. Johnson didn't deal with mandatory consecutive time. And the system, I would submit to you, going back to you know, the other justice's question about the statute. The statute does require the, you know, or the statutes presume that we run these concurrent, that they're not consecutive. And the Attorney General's office said this can be overcome in rare cases. Where we run them consecutively. Well, in that case, we advise. This is an individual who's going in and considering all of those things.
His plea form did tell him that they could be run consecutively, correct?
But it's mandatory consecutive, and I think there's a distinction there because there's no discretion here upon the court. So it's not as if he would appear for a sentencing hearing and the court could say, well, this, you know, I found these factors and this is, you know, this is, and I want to sentence you to consecutive. The court doesn't have that discretion. There is going to be no concurrent. So when an individual faces the trial court and faces all of these considerations that I spoke about when I began, he's going to think about what the consequences are, and he wasn't advised of those. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision.